And very nice to have your company. 21 2101 if you're texting us, or the panel at radionz.co.nz. Zara Potts. I better get my mouth working. That'll be of some assistance over the next couple of hours. Zara Potts with what the world is talking about today. The importance of failing in life, an interesting address from the President of Iceland. Richard Branson's ideas about taking holidays. As often as you want, as long as you want. Let's all go and work for him. Mm. The great ukulele feud, the link between stress at work and asthma. Companies suffering because they're called ISIS, and what is the correct name for those terrorists anyway? The importance of making food sound like it tastes. On the panel today, Steve McCabe. Hello, Steve.
Good afternoon.
Soon to be joined by Neil Miller, I think. Pike River and the paucity of answers about what has been stopping solid energy giving the tick to going back down. The Labour Party, poverty, poetry, the poems you remember, what are they? Actually, you could tell us that if you want. The verse you keep in your head, 2101. Or, in fact, give us your opinion about anything we talk about. Zara.
Hello.
How shall we begin?
We're going to begin with failure, because that's always a good thing to begin with, isn't it?
Well, it's a constant attendant in life.
Yes, it is.
And it can only get better, really.
Exactly. It's... So it can only go up from here. Now, this is the Clinton Global Initiative, which is being held in New York as we speak. And this is a group of people that global leaders that convene to create solutions to the world's problems. Now, as you were saying, the President of Iceland has given a speech, and he talks about failure, and he talks about the fact that failure might actually be very good for us. And he's basically urged everybody to change our mindsets that failure is a bad thing and look at it as actually a positive. So he was talking at this conference about the fact that people have to be fundamentally willing to fail. He then gave his own example of when Iceland failed spectacularly during the global crisis. But since then, his country has transformed itself into a great example of how to fail successfully.
Yeah, but did they pay all that money back to the British bank, Steve? I've forgotten.
I wasn't there at the time.
There were a few IOUs owing. Yeah. It's easier to rise again like a phoenix from the ashes.
Did they take? They didn't take the bailout though, did they? They put it sort of back together.
Oh no, they have done really well.
Yeah, they have. Yeah. And basically, he was just saying, look, you can take failure and you can actually turn it into, you can make it into a success
if you learn from it. Otherwise,
yeah.
It's if you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always got.
Exactly. Well,
this is an age old spin. I think it was an Edison who used to say that I didn't fail 100 times. I found 100 ways that weren't successful.
Yeah.
It's just a way of looking at things.
Yeah.
Especially with other people's money.
My mother always said there are no mistakes, only lessons.
Oh, your mother was a wise woman.
Still is.
Still is. Yeah.
But basically, he's just saying, look, society needs to transform itself so that if and when, and this is quite interesting, if political leaders attempt to change the world and fail, it won't cost them the next election. So, take a chance.
Do you altogether believe that?
Well,
the trouble is it can cost you the next election.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
and it can also cost you, your house when you can't pay the mortgage, all those things. That's the problem.
Yes.
Did many people turn out
no,
to listen?
That's the irony of it. The fear of failure may have been evident in the turnout because it was a pretty small audience.
Right.
So therefore it may have, they didn't want to know about it.
The speech itself was a relative failure.
That was a bit of a failure.
4:10. Now, Richard Branson's advice.
This is interesting. Interest in jobs at Virgin is likely to soar following suggestions by Richard Branson that people should be able to take time off work whenever they want, rather than constantly weighing up how much annual leave they have. In an excerpt from his new book, Branson wrote, it should be left to the employee alone to decide if and when he or she feels like taking a few hours or a day or a week or even a month off. He said that the plan is already in action at Virgin offices in Britain and the US, and if it works, he will encourage all of the company's subsidiaries to stop counting holiday leave. But he didn't say whether or not that leave is paid.
Well, that's reasonably crucial.
So that is a crucial point to know whether or not those employees are actually getting paid for that. You wouldn't be able to run a system like that, would you?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you simply say, here is the work that you're required to do, and it must be done, do it in any time frame that you see fit, and if the work is done, we'll pay you for it. That's one thing. I'm just wondering, I mean, the man owns a number of airlines.
Mm.
So how does this work for, say, the flight crew? If the captain suddenly goes, I'm tired. I'm not going to knock off halfway over the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, you've got to complete the present task.
It's not quite as flexible as he would have us believe.
No, life isn't quite as flexible as that. But it's a lovely dream. But you'd run out of money. That's the problem with this.
Well, he started considering this concept after his daughter told him that Netflix was doing it. And apparently that company has experienced a marked upward shift in morale, creativity and productivity. Mm. So, I mean, maybe it does work.
I'm actually familiar with a company that does this.
Mm.
It's a company named Automatic, which publish the web publishing platform that I use for my web design. And all of their staff are hired on this basis. They work from home. They don't work in an office. They're a completely distributed workforce. And they're simply told, you must complete your work. If you complete your work, you get paid. We don't care how you do it. We don't care when you do it, so long as it gets done.
That's okay for a certain type of work, of course.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it wouldn't work for you, Jim.
No.
No.
No, it wouldn't work for most people, I think.
No,
because there's a difference between completing a task and doing it well, which might take the extra time.
Well, if usually so you don't feel like completing a task right now, you'll do it in the evening. Mm. You know, Brian Crump might have a word or two to say about that.
There'd be constant squabbling.
Yes. I'm sure my principal would take a very dim view of me taking a similar approach.
I'll do it at night.
Yes.
Night classes. No. Now, this is interesting. Speaking of work, a major new study has found that people fearful of losing their jobs are 60% more likely to develop asthma for the first time as a result of their stress, which is that's a pretty big statistic. And now this is an international team of researchers analysed data from more than 7,000 workers, and even allowing for other risk factors such as smoking and being overweight, they discovered that work-related stress raises the risk of developing asthma. And it found that those workers who were worried about losing their jobs were more likely to develop it at a rate of 2.12% compared with 1.3% of people who had no such worry. And for every 25% increase in the perceived threat of job loss, the risk of asthma rose by 24%.
That's an interesting correlation,
yeah,
isn't it, though?
Yeah. So now this research was actually conducted by experts from the University of Dusseldorf and Amsterdam, and also our very own Massey University.
Okay.
Yeah, and it talks particularly around the use of temporary contracts and other forms of contracting, as well as downsizing, and also the economic crisis in Europe apparently has been blamed as having accelerated the development of this.
I must go down to the sea again. Actually, I think it's must down to the sea again. I think it is must, I must down, I could be wrong. The lonely sea in the sky, and all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by. Good afternoon, Neil Miller.
Good afternoon.
Listeners' suggestions coming in for their favourite lines of verse, you see.
That's a nice one.
Seasons of mists and mellow fruitfulness. Mm. Wrong season. Wrong time of the year. That was one from Britain. Zara Potts.
Right. Now, the Islamic State, otherwise known as ISIS, is a very scary kind of organisation, and lots of talk about this of late. But there seems to be some confusion over the actual name of the group. You may have heard Barack Obama calling it ISIL.
Yeah.
David Cameron's been doing the same. Australia calls it ISIS, and we follow suit. But it's also sometimes abbreviated to just IS.
Yeah,
Islamic
no, we're
State.
Doing IS now.
Yeah, yeah. Now, just to add to the confusion, France's François Hollande has now renamed the group Daesh.
Daesh.
So what is going on? Well, the naming conflict has deep historic and cultural roots. It's had a number of names since it originated way back in 1999. It wasn't until 2006 that the group became known as Islamic State in Iraq, or ISI. And then in 2013, it declared itself as the Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, which is the historic Arabic name for Syria. Thus, we get ISIS. As for ISIL, well, that comes from the antiquated French phrase that referred to those lands as the Levant.
The Levant, yeah.
Levant, yeah, which, of course, explains Obama's ISIL.
So it went ISIL,
yes, and now IS, back to IS.
What do you two say?
Well, that's what you call them, ISIS.
ISIL.
That would work, yeah.
Yeah, thanks very much. Neil, what do you say?
Well, I'm no great supporter of terrorism, but I think if a group calls itself something, it should really be called that in the media and not, like, translated by other world leaders. I'd known it as ISIS, but I'd noticed recently it had switched to IS.
Mm.
And where does Daesh come from?
Well, Daesh, this is an interesting one. It is actually an Arabic acronym for the group, but the word does have negative connotations in both French and Arabic.
Then stick with that one then, definitely.
Yeah, well, Hollande has said that he's just simply going to use the term Daesh cutthroats for the organisation. So,
All right.
Yeah.
But the word ISIS is having an impact on businesses.
Yeah, now this is interesting. Small businesses, well, and probably big businesses, particularly in Britain, it doesn't sound right, does it? But there are a surprising amount of British businesses that share the name of the terrorist group. Everything from surveying businesses to financial companies like ISIS Equity Partners, and some of them are changing their names just because they don't want that association. There are countless examples of this, from hairdressers to kebab shops. And one of the reasons that the name is so popular is because of the association association with the ancient Egyptian goddess Isis,
yeah.
Who was renowned for her beauty. So you get a lot of beauty shops that are called Isis Beauty and things
like
that.
If I'm not mistaken, either Cambridge or Oxford University yes. Student Union newspapers called Isis.
Well, they have a boat. Their reserve boat is called Isis.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They are refusing to change the name of that. So they're saying no, they will not change the name. Even Downton Abbey, the dog. The yellow Labrador in Downton Abbey is called Isis.
It's called Isis.
Mm.
Yeah, and no one, to be fair, is going to confuse that dog with a bunch of beheading Arabs, really, are they? So
no, but people might think the dog was named after the group.
After the group, yeah. And it's, apparently the name is very ubiquitous in Britain, so it's going
Well, it must be if a kebab shop thinks, you know, what do I associate with my kebabs that I'm making at, like, 10 o'clock at night for drunk people? Oh, the Egyptian goddess of beauty. That's obviously the name I should go for.
Someone suggests MITO, Middle East Terror Organization.
Yeah,
Now, the way food sounds.
Food sounds. And whether food sounds actually influence whether we like things or not. Now, going back to the time of Plato, some 2,500 years ago, we find that he came up with an idea called naturalism, which is the concept that a name might fit naturally around an object, or that a name may sound naturally sweeter than others. Right. And this then has a bearing on how we view it. Modern linguistic research apparently supports this position, and it's all about vowels, apparently. Two vowel sounds, the first being front vowels, like the E in cheese or the I in mint, and then back vowels, which is like the O in bold and the A in large. And so these are basically made with different, you know, your tongue's in a different place in your mouth.
Yes.
Now, across most languages of the world, these front vowels tend to be used in words that are for small things, and the back vowels tend to be used in words like for big, fat, heavy things.
Right,
generally.
And they did an experiment.
They did. A marketing study did an experiment on this, and they asked people, they made up names and then asked people what sounded better. So for things like ketchup, Nallin or Nullin, and Nullin was picked as the better one because it was
It's heavy
yeah. and thicker. Okay. And so now they looked at ice cream for this as well. And sure enough, if you look at ice cream, there's all sorts of names with back vowels like Rocky Road, Almond Fudge, Chocolate, Caramel, Cookie dough, coconut, they tend to have those kind of names, whereas things like crackers, things that you think of as being light, have front vowel names like Ritz, cheese, chips,
cheesels, crisps,
wheat thins, crispies, triscuits, all of that kind of stuff.
All the things that kids like.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So if you renamed broccoli...
Brickly.
Then the children probably eat the brickly.
That sounds much better, doesn't it?
Mm. Or bristle spritz.
Bristle spritz.
Yeah. I did read a while back that basically there are exactly three foods that sound exactly how they taste.
Yeah.
Blancmange.
Oh, blancmange.
Yogurt. And flan.
Blancmange does taste like it sounds.
It does a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's onomatopoeia.
That's true. But that's a good idea. So I don't know. Maybe we should think about saying have some broccoli.
I reckon you have a lot of success with broccoli.
Broccoli. It sounds like a plan to me. Now, just quickly, the wakeboard. There is an electric surfboard that is coming onto the market next year. It goes 46 k's an hour, the surfboard, so it'll be more annoying than a jet ski. And you'd quite like one, wouldn't you?
Whether I could stay on it would be the thing. But you can see this online, can't you, if people have a Google?
Yeah. It's called the Radden Board. And you can have a look at it. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you. Zara Potts with what the world is talking about. There was a Morris Isis, a car, as well, by the way.
Oh.
Steve McCabe, Neil Miller coming up on the panel.